Greg, I really need to start paying more attention, or at least start paying attention a little more closely when I watch games and specifically when I read the rule book. I'm starting to feel like I don't have a handle on this game anymore.
I think the rule book, sir, is very explicit and detailed, and I can't imagine there'd be any gray area in the rule book. Whatever do you mean?
Well, first of all, Greg, as I'm sure you can tell, is on Skype. Greg, about to leave for his vacation in the very sunny climes of somewhere south. Well, here's what I noticed yesterday, and I didn't know this was a penalty, and I didn't notice it until I saw Andrew Desjardins hit Jamal Mayers yesterday, get 2-5 and a 10. Hello, match. Hello, gone for the game. I didn't know that deliberately targeting the shoulder was a penalty worthy of banishment from a game. Did you know that?
I was unaware. I read all the rules about headshots. I read all the rules about those sorts of illegal hits. I didn't realize, sir, that targeting the shoulder was, in fact, illegal.
You know, Jamal Mayer's shoulder was in a vulnerable position. The shoulder was down. He was about to receive a check. And Andrew Desjardins, as the video shows, recklessly and deliberately targeted his shoulder and launched himself at the shoulder. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that was. I gotta scramble back and have a look at the rule book. But I was unaware that that was a penalty. I was unaware that was a match.
I'm just as surprised as you are. This is twice now, sir. This is twice now in the span of a week in which the officials have blown a call, egregiously blown a call. And I'm still trying to figure out, as we talked about earlier this week, whether it's a symptom of them being rusty after the lockout, or is a symptom of the overprotection of players in the new NHL, because everybody's so concerned about getting your noggin rocked. What do you think it is? Do you think they're off their game, or do you think it's overprotection?
I think it's both. I think it's, as we said before, it's there's a hysteria about concussions, specifically in hockey. Football is to a whole different degree. And so I think now the defer is always, if it looks bad, call it as if it is. And you know me, Wish. I don't like slowing the game down. I don't want too much video review. I will plug my nose and say I'll put up with a coach's challenge, but I don't want games to last 3 hours. Like, I know the NHL has that concern as well. They do not want three-hour regular season games. They don't want that. They want nice and tidy, two-and-a-half-hour package. You're in, you're out. Go home, turn off the television. That's what they want. But for a penalty that's so severe that it kicks a player out of the game, and it's a quick, easy video review as well. When the depth of the penalty is so great, I think that's an area now where we have to look at and say, we need to have a video review for hits where guys are getting kicked out of the game. You could argue it cost St. Louis that game against Detroit. Backus goes off after the hit against Huskins. That's six scores on the penalty. That's the game-winning goal. Yesterday, same thing, San Jose and Chicago. So for that, I'm willing to plug my nose and say, that is an area now where officials are having a hard time getting the call right, because let's face it, that's a difficult call to make. The Backus call was a hard to make. It's bang, bang, it's flash, it's fast, and all you see is the effects, because we've seen it before with guys targeting the head. But when you're sending someone to the showers for the rest of the game, don't you think that needs to go to video review, Wish?
That's a slippery slope, though.
It's a slippery slope.
I mean, that means every major penalty should be reviewed, doesn't it? I mean, that means like the Dubinsky boarding call in Scuderi, or, you know, although it's not a major penalty, I mean, that kind of play would be reviewed, wouldn't it? I mean, if you're going to review the headshot thing because ostensibly it's because you're kicking a guy out of the game, you're getting a 5-minute major via the team, then every major penalty should be reviewed, shouldn't it?
Well, then if you can't do a video review, then you know what we can do about it?
What?
Or you know what anybody can do anything about it? Nothing. Zero. It's a really, honestly, I was thinking about this last night on the way back from Sportsnet. Like, well, what can be done about this other than slow it down and go to video review? And you know what I've come up with?
What?
Zero. You can't do anything about it but say, you know what? Hockey players aren't perfect. Coaches aren't perfect. We shouldn't expect officials to be perfect. That's all. Well, that's all that I can come up with.
You know, I wrote on Puck Daddy just before about how the NHL should let us know what they do for these officials that blow calls. And someone brought up an interesting point, and I kind of get this, but at the same time, I don't. Like, I think there's a basic standard for officiating in the National Hockey League, which is don't screw up epically. Like, it's okay to get a tripping call wrong. It's okay to get a holding call wrong, or to give somebody the wrong penalty on a roughing scrum if they were goaded into it. But if you screw up a goal, if you screw up a major penalty that involves the player getting kicked out of the game, I feel like there needs to be some repercussions for that. And I feel like there maybe are. We're just not privy to it.
So, well, you know what the repercussions – first of all, I know the repercussions are pretty easy. It's playoff assignments. It's
extra
money.
Yeah, but shouldn't there be more? But shouldn't there be some kind of a kangaroo court in the National Hockey League where if you're a referee that blows the call, you get maybe some pay doc? I mean, and when players step over the line, we know how much they get paid, how much of their pay gets docked. Shouldn't it be the same thing for officials?
I don't know. When it comes to officials, I don't know that I want my officials thinking game to game as opposed to the entire body of work over the year, because officials are going to blow calls. They are. They're going to miss calls just like players are going to forget to drag their toe and they're going to go offside. They're going to make mistakes.
Oh. And that was the way it was put to me, Merrick. The way it was put to me was that a referee blowing a call is akin to a player missing an open net.
Yeah.
But I don't see it that way. I don't see it that way at all. I see it as a referee.
So,
Making an egregious mistake, and when players make egregious mistakes, we know about it. It's printed. We get an email about it every day if a player is suspended or if he's punished for doing something bad. If a referee does something bad, you know what happens? He gets the reputation of being incompetent, but we never know if the league actually does anything to rectify the situation. Can you imagine the celebrations across the National Hockey League if we found out that the league actually disciplined Tim Peel for being completely incompetent at his job?
They do punish them. Guys, you know, contracts don't get renewed. Guys don't get playoff assignments. That's extra money. They stop working. There are punishments for poor officiating. Like, these guys don't stay in the league very long if you're a horrible official. Trust me on this. I know this firsthand. There have been lawsuits for wrongful dismissal filed by NHL officials against the National Hockey League. It does happen. We're just, you know, you just really have to pay attention to what's happening to the official and who gets the assignments and who gets the calls come postseason. That's what you can judge. That's what you can say, okay, this is how Terry Gregson and the NHL feels about this official. This is how they feel about this linesman. This is how they feel about this referee. Hey, how about this one, Wish? How about this idea? Are we at a point now with the speed of the game and with how challenging it is to call effectively? Because, listen, everybody on the ice missed that yesterday. Just like everybody on the ice missed the David Backes hit. Everybody got it wrong. You know, we've seen some phantom goalie interference calls that everybody on the ice has gotten wrong because the guys can confer and go over what happened. We saw it in the LA-Edmonton game with Sam Gagner and Jonathan Quick. Are we at a point now where the National Hockey League needs a, ready for it, tennis-style judge sitting above the eye in the sky? And I guess you could say the video review is that eye in the sky. But are we at the place now where we have the tennis judge in hockey?
You know, what you're saying is not that outlandish, because they were actually considering that position, right, during one of the Shanahan camps, weren't they?
Yeah, two camps ago they were.
Two camps ago, they had the chair. I remember Myrtle had the picture. They had the chair all set up, and they were going to have one of the officials up in the chair the entire time. Would that remedy it, though, is the question. Would that remedy it?
I don't know. Again, I'm just fishing for some type of answer.
Hey,
I don't know.
I'm not opposed to it because, A, it would open up the ice. Take a body off the ice, right? Open up the ice a little bit more. We all love that. And then B, who knows? Maybe that vantage point does afford somebody to be able to call the play better. You never know.
I don't know that I want to take an official off the ice, though. I think this game is too fast now for one referee to get up and down the ice effectively and do what he has to do. I think you need to. I'm at that point now. I liked when the game was slower. I liked the one referee, because he could cover everything off. He could see everything, make his decisions. But right now, considering how fast the sprints are, can you imagine how exhausted a single referee would be if you had to keep pace with an entire game? There's no 45-second shifts for a referee. If you had to go the full 60 strong, up and down, stops and starts, dig in your knees, and make calls at the same time, I'm firmly in the camp now that one referee can't do that effectively.
You'd
be like, you got to be Superman. You better put a cape on that referee in order to get that one.
I don't know, man. I'm all for transparency. I'm all for accountability. I agree with you. Like, you can look at the playoff assignments and know who's been a good boy and who's been a bad boy. I just don't know if that is necessarily putting the kind of pressure I'd like to see applied to the officials to do their job better. And I know what you're going to say. It's a very stressful job. You got pucks flying at your face. You got punches being thrown at you during scrums. These guys are putting their reputations on the line every night, and they're never winning any popularity contests. But when you see the Bacchus thing, when you see the Desjardins thing, and they're both just so damn egregious and so terrible and so wrong, as a fan, I'd like to know that the league is being very proactive with their guys in making sure that they get the calls right. And maybe there just needs to be more communication. You know, there's so much communication when other league employees step out of line that we know exactly what's said to them. We know exactly what the repercussions are. We know all this stuff about the process in disciplinary measures from the league to its players. Maybe we just need someone like Mick Magoo or Terry Gregson or someone to step forward and be like, here's how we handled this situation with this official, and here's how we're going to try to ensure that David Backus isn't kicked out of another game for a hit to the chest. Maybe we just need more communication, Merrick, between the league and the fans in that regard.
Keep in mind one thing, too, though, Wish. The NHL does not want to ever shine attention on referees. After the referee strike, that was it. The names came off the back, right? They want robots. They don't want any I'm sure it pains them even to have identified by a number on the backs of their sweaters. They do not want any attention. They don't want press releases. They don't want nameplates. They don't want anyone to follow the sidebar story, which is always running, and it's a fascinating one, which is always running in the NHL, and that is which referees do what and how do different referees call different games and call different infractions. Because whether the NHL wants to admit it or not, or Terry Gregson does, everybody officiates a little bit differently than one another. I don't have a problem with it. And complicating the fact is that now you have two referees on the ice who both have their own style and their own flavor as well. So let's not forget that, you know, as much as we would love that transparency and love Terry Gregson to come out and say what happened with this official and how we discipline, the NHL does not want any attention paid to their officials, period.
Well, we know that, and that's why no one's allowed to talk to them after games after they blow calls. And that's why we still don't know what happened to the Patrick Kane puck.
Hey, that's a great question. What, boy, was that ever a tempest? What do you know what happened to it? What was the finality on it?
Well, there was a giant article. Wayne Dres, I believe his name is, or Deers, or I forget how to pronounce his name, but he's a writer for ESPN the magazine, and he went on this hunt, this Oliver Stone-esque hunt for the puck, and it was a great story. He confronted Steve Miller, the linesman, after a couple of games. And Miller was very nonplussed about it and almost like felt like he was concealing something. And you couldn't figure out if he was concealing, you knew what happened to the puck or if he didn't, but he was just very dodgy about it. And the NHL doesn't allow these guys to be available. So it gets a little bit hinky. But, you know, the Steve Miller thing, my personal theory on this whole thing, I don't even remember if there was an official explanation for what happened to the Patrick Kane puck. But I always thought that he had the puck and then he like threw it out or something. Like he did something to the puck that would be so embarrassing if it came out that he's just concealed it the entire time. That's my theory.
So it's like the Pat Stapleton story from 1972, the Henderson goal puck. And for years and years, because a couple of guys saw Pat Stapleton going to the net, fish it out, and take the puck. And for years and years, Stapleton always denied it because there was no video evidence of it. And then one day, another angle appeared of the Henderson goal, and during the celebration, you can see Pat Stapleton go into the net and take the puck out and put it in his hockey pants. And finally, Stapleton said, oh, yeah, okay, so fine, I took the puck. And they asked him where it was. He goes, I don't know, I have a frozen rink in my backyard. I probably shot into a snowbank. I have no idea where the puck is. So those are the two great puck crusades and puck dilemmas in the history of the game.
There you go. All right, on the show today, folks, everybody gird your loins, because Jeff Merrick, Man Crush, David Clarkson is on the show, which of course means a New Jersey Devil is on the show the day after they defeat the New York Rangers. So you may want to get a mop out. I'm just saying. You may need to get a
you
mop.
You know what?
maybe put down some newspaper before this interview.
You know what today is, Wish? Today is, as we like to say in the business, a dark suit day.
Exactly. And then also it is the return, the second week of Jeff and Greg are going postal. The Ask Us Anything episode that we do every Wednesday, and get your questions in, puckdaddyblog@yahoo.com, at Wyshynski, at Jeff Merrick on the Twitter, hashtag at NBSW. We already got a bunch of really interesting ones on in the queue, ranging from wrestling to tattoos. As always, the listeners, Merrick, have gone interesting places with their queries to us, so we'll get to those as well. And with that, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Are you familiar with the game called hockey?
All I have to do is talk for a living.
If you say lube 10 times, you just feel better.
You say lube 10 times, you're going to feel better.
Why shouldn't I always be happy? I'm stealing money.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I went through life with this last name, okay? I'm a kindly old wizard. Close your eyes, hold your nose, swallow the medicine.
Debate hockey.
Swift Current Broncos. Lethbridge Hurricanes. The Vancouver Giants.
God. Pop culture.
I don't want to be culturally insensitive. I never am on this show, so we still may have Twinkies here in the States.
Still may have the ho-ho. Good news,
might have the ding-dong.
And more hockey.
Jeff Merrick on the puck. Knocking the biscuit around.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Let's start the show proper, shall we?
Before we get to Chief Larkin, I wanted to ask you, Mr. Merrick.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on the Brandon Dubinsky hit on Scuderi last night.
Wait a minute. Is this the same Rob Scuderi who was reckless with his body along the boards in Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final, leading to the hit by Steve Bernier? That same Rob Scuderi?
Now, I went back and looked at the Bernier hit, and I feel like the Dubinsky hit is more of a riding a guy into the corner than the Bernier hit, which was a skating all the way into the zone and then finishing a check with the guy's back turned. That's the way I see it, at least.
Well, I see the Dubinsky hit. I didn't see it as deliberately malicious. I just saw it as a guy trying to pinch out a defenseman and get position and separation from man and puck.
You know my thoughts on the Bernier hit, obviously. I've made it quite clear on the show. But I get what you're saying about Scuderi as a player and showing the numbers in a situation like that. And I think that we both agree, based on that and based on what Dubinsky appeared to be trying to do on the hit, would you give him a suspension?
I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't.
It's
spend
a tough call. I might not. I might not on that one. I might not.
I mean, here we are, what, 9 games after the fact? And I don't want to see like crapping all over Rob Scuderi, but, you know, it's, you know, 9 games later after Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final, or 10 games later, and it's Rob Scuderi putting himself in a dangerous position along the boards, behind the net.
Yeah.
Again. I mean,
the thing is that Shanahan and the league take that into account, though. They take that, at least that's what they've said to me, is that they take into account what kind of player these guys are, what they've done in the past, what their reputation is as far as their role in the hit. And if that's the case, then I think it's impossible to not see Scuderi as the type of player who draws in opponents to doing stuff like that.
That would be an interesting super stat for me. I'm sure someone is keeping this stat, or maybe not. And if not, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to put yourself on the map in my book, someone come up with this stat. Find me the players year in and year out who are hit from behind more often than anybody else.
Yeah.
That would be a fascinating one to me.
Who got suspended and get a sense of which players drew boarding suspensions, for example. Boarding majors. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not just even boarding majors. I mean, look at Tom Pody and Nazem Kadri last night. Did you think that was particularly egregious by Kadri? I didn't. I just kind of
You're of the opinion that Tom Pody may not be the strongest skater.
Not just me. Not just me. I mean, for a big guy, and Tom Pody's a big dude. I mean, we've seen it before. That's barely a little touch.
Yeah.
Right? Now, mind you, he did have enough presence and enough time to get his hands up on the play, but It wasn't as if he got rocked by Rafi Torres come cannonballing in from the blue line. It was a push from Kadri. I'm maybe not the strongest player on his skates.
Maybe not.
And so as we
wait for David Clarkson to join us here on the program, I will give you, sir, the first going postal question of the day. It's from our good friend Mohit Bagotra. And Mohit would like to know, hey, Greg and Jeff, does the NHL test for marijuana? If not, which players are stoners? Thanks and keep doing what you do.
Well, Clayton, for one.
That's brilliant.
Do they test for, I don't know what specifically they test for.
This is from sportsinlaw.com from February of 2012. They may have changed the policy in the next CBA, but this is at least the policy from last February. The NHL tests for steroids, hormones, and basic doping tests.
Okay.
So it ain't like they're testing for Mary Jane or heroin, according to this.
Right. Okay, that's fine, but I mean, I would argue marijuana is not a performance enhancer. Although, hang on a second, I mean, that is one of those things. It's much like sleeping pills, and that's a huge issue in the NHL right now. And specifically now, when you look at guys that are doing like, you know, 4 games in 6 nights, and the travel is awful. Specifically, if you're in a market like Columbus or Detroit, and you're aching and you're in pain and you got to get to sleep because you have a skate in the morning, whether it's sleeping pills or it's a joint. I mean, the amount of assistance a hockey player must need right now, given the demands of a 48-game schedule and the demands of travel. I mean, even if it's just having like a pot cookie before you go to bed, that wouldn't shock me at all. So I don't know that it's performance enhancing, but it's performance enabling because it allows you to get to sleep so you can wake up and you can actually perform your job.
Would it be performance enhancing for a goaltender to smoke a blunt before a game?
I think in the old days when they were neurotic and then when goaltenders were scared of the puck. I don't see any goaltenders that are scared of the puck anymore, unless Sheldon Surrey's winding up. I don't see anyone really scared of the puck anymore. Back in the days of Terry Sawchuk and Johnny Bower and Glenn Hall, yeah, man, I could see that as a way just to mellow you out a little bit before the game, get rid of some of the puck terrors.
So what you're saying is that we should celebrate the legacy of Jacques Plante and the goalie mask because it probably reduced the chances that goalies were smoking fatties before games to calm their nerves, is what you're saying.
Listen, it's no surprise that a lot of those goaltenders became horrible alcoholics. Terry Sawchuk was top of the list. A lot of those guys drank, one, out of pain, and two, out of fear. Dangerous job. Only 6 of them in the world at that time. So I don't blame those guys a bit. I don't blame Terry Sawchuk for the path that he went down, and I don't blame any other of those goaltenders from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. 60s specifically with the curved sticks and the raised pucks. And Bobby Hull and Stan Mikita shooting up around your ears. Our guest is standing by. Fresh off a 2-goal performance as his New Jersey Devils took out the New York Rangers yesterday. He leads the Devils in scoring and is knocking at the door of top 10 in the NHL, to say nothing of knocking at the door of a nice big contract come July when his extension is due. David Clarkson, the New Jersey Devils, joins us. David, how are you today, sir?
Good, yourself? Awesome, man.
Doing very well. I know you're joking yesterday with Patrick Elias. How much money are you going to cut Patrick Elias in on your next deal, considering he had the 3 assists yesterday? I know you're always a defer to your teammates kind of guy, but how do you explain your early season success this year?
You know what? Just being in those areas of the ice, like I've mentioned, playing with Patty is a pretty easy guy to play with. But I think getting to those areas, it's those areas of the ice that are down around that net, and the puck seems to just be finding me there, or Patty making nice plays like he did. And when you get to play with guys like Henrique, and I was a little bit with Zajac as well, it definitely helps a ton when you're out there, when guys can move the puck like that. But I think just being in those spots of the ice that the pucks seeming to find me.
Does beating the New York Rangers ever get old?
You know what? It's that rivalry, it's that playoff hockey, and it's something that you get out of bed that morning, you're ready to go. It's one of those games that doesn't take too much to get up for, but every time we play them, it's that type of hockey the fans love. And they're a great hockey team. They're well coached. They do a lot of good things, and they've got some great talent on that team. So it's definitely fun when you win a game like that, such a big game. And our crowd's been unbelievable since the start of this season, and it was a great building to be in last night.
Well, specifically when they're chanting Enrique at Henrik Lundqvist, that's always a nice little touch. Your thoughts on your coach? I mean, you had him in junior, Peter DeBoer, with the Kitchener Rangers. Now with the New Jersey Devils, with him to the Stanley Cup Final last year, with him, of course, again this year. Have you seen, because David Clarkson, the player, has evolved, have you seen Peter DeBoer, the coach, evolve as well?
Yeah, you know what? Pete's always been that same type of coach. I think when I had him in junior, he was someone that believed that if you believed in him and the system he installed and what he was preaching to you, what he wanted you to do as a player and as a team, he believed that if you did that, you would be successful. And he's always had that same type of mindset. He's somebody that believes in systems and believes that if we stick to what he's asking of us, then we are going to be successful. And that's why I think him coming to Jersey and doing what he's done with this team is incredible. It shows the type of coach he is and how good he's always been. We did the same in junior. You know, when we won a Memorial Cup there, he had us all on the same page and buying in that every player is a piece to the puzzle and you stick to what you have to do and you'll be successful.
Can you talk about the maturation of your offensive repertoire? There was a time, David Clarkson, when the old joke was the David Clarkson wraparound was the only move that David Clarkson had. But you've got moves now, man. You're doing some things with the puck that maybe you haven't been doing in years past. Well, how's your offensive game come around?
You know what? I think every summer you try and get better. You know, you can never be, even though you're playing in the NHL, I think if you sit there and say, I'm happy to be here, and you've got to go home and work on things. And I've done that every year. I've tried to get better and better every year. You know, I think playing with guys like I've mentioned, but I think you go home and you really sit there and try and get better at certain situations and experience. Confidence comes with it. The more years you play in the league, you feel more comfortable. And when you're younger, you feel like you got to chip the puck and go, or, you know, the coach might bench me if I don't do this. But I think the more you play and the more comfortable you get, the better things go.
Being joined by David Clarkson of the New Jersey Devils. Talk to us a little bit about this year's edition of the Devils. And a lot was made with the loss of Zach Parise. He goes to the Minnesota Wild. Was that even discussed to open up this year, you know, life without, you know, the former captain? Or was it just business as usual? He's not here, so we can't focus on him.
Yeah, you know what? Zach was one of the best teammates I've had. He's somebody that competes at a level that is hard to replace and hard to find. But at the end of the day, there's been a lot of guys that I've played with here. A ton of guys from Gomez, Gionta, Rafalski, a lot of guys that we've had that were top guys, Paul Martin, that leave. And it's credit to Mr. Lamoriello. He seems to find players or people out there that no one would think or that, and every year we're competitive. Every year we come out and play hard and somebody seems to fill a void or fill a hole. So, you know, Zach's doing great, and he'll always do great just because of his work ethic and the type of player he is. But as a team and an organization, I think you've got to move on, and you've got to be ready for what's ahead of you.
We were talking before about the Desjardins match penalty and the David Booth match penalty that have both been rescinded in the past week. And I wanted to ask you, as a guy who definitely brings a physical game, kind of plays on the edge sometimes, are you at all more hesitant now than you were maybe 2 years ago, given the way the league has cracked down on certain hits? Or do you just kind of go out there and do the same thing you've done?
Yeah, you know what? I came into this league that way, and I'll always play that way. I think when I'm in close to a corner, if a guy's back's turned or something, I'm a little more hesitant. But if I'm going in and I'm at four on the forecheck, I'm going to finish that guy, especially if he's facing me or if I feel I've got a clean play. It's tough as a player sometimes because it's that fine line where you're maybe poking at the puck or give a guy a push and he goes in awkwardly. I don't think it's ever something that guys mean to do, but it's such a fast game that these things happen. But me personally, no. When I'm going into that forecheck, I'm going to finish that guy and go for that puck because that's part of my job and part of makes a team successful is if we're hard on that forecheck.
You know, you mentioned that every year you try to improve yourself, get better, improve different areas. What do you think that David Clarkson still needs to work on?
There's lots of things. I think every year you try and work on your skating, work on your hands, or, you know, I go home and work with a lot of people in the summer, especially this summer with the lockout. Really, you know, we went far in the playoffs there, and you're a little bit banged up from the playoffs, so I think I had time to rest and get better and then get back at it and get that more time on the ice to work on little things. And Toronto's such a great place to live that there's some of the best players there, and you get to be around some of them and train with them, and it really really helps.
Are you missing Western Conference and West Coast road trips this year?
You know what? This is a first for me, the shortened schedule, and it's a lot of games in a short period of time, but it's fun. I'm really enjoying it. It's something that's, it reminds you of, it feels like you're in the playoffs. You know, everything's so tight and so close. Every night you've got to come out and do something, because you lose one, two, or three games, and you know, you really do slip, and there's not enough games to make up for it. So, do I miss the long road trips? It's sometimes it's nice. You get team building when you get on the road and those long ones, but it's nice to be home now and get to be home in my own bed most nights for sure.
You know, every player kind of has, you know, outside of his own home rink, another favorite rink to play in, one that you always find that you have a successful night, one that you scored a big goal, had a big fight, had a big moment in your career. David, is there one other rink other than the Prudential that you just say to yourself, man, I always play well at this barn?
I would have to say home. I'd have to say when I go home to Toronto, it's, you know, I grew up there. I grew up a big Maple Leafs fan and always sit in Maple Leaf Gardens with my dad as a kid. And so I think whenever I get in that, you know, back home in that city there, it's something that maybe the adrenaline gets going a little more. But, yeah, I'd have to say that rink is probably the Air Canada Centre there in Toronto.
Last one for me, David Clarkson. As Merrick pointed out before, you are probably in line for a pretty nice payday this summer, given your stat, given your maturation as a player, and given the fact you're an unrestricted free agent. How much of that plays off in your mind as you're going this season? Are you able to avoid thoughts of swimming in dollar bills this summer as you're playing this game currently?
You know what? To be honest with you, it's something that I haven't thought about it all. That's part of it. I think I just go out there and I'm enjoying being around the rink with the guys, doing the, you know, fortunate enough to play a game for a living. So I'm just taking it all in and playing the season. And when the season ends, then you know, I'll sit down and figure things out. But Jersey's always been a great organization to me. Mr. Lamorello has been unbelievable for giving me the opportunity, and those are things really that I haven't really thought about.
You know, maybe the answer, and I'll end on this, David, maybe the answer is the team you just played last night. When I asked you about favorite arena to play in outside of your own, do you have a favorite team to play against, like one team that you get up for more than anyone else in the NHL?
I would have to say, like, the Rangers, the Flyers, those are, I think when you play here in New Jersey for a long period of time, you start to, you learn the rivalry between the teams and the in-division games. And so I would have to say, probably New York and Philly are the two. It just feels like playoff hockey every time we play them, and it's that's the type of game I love to play, and it's fun, and you know, like I said, that rivalry is so big, and the fans are so into it that makes it big.
On that, we'll let you go. David, thanks for this. Congratulations on the early season success. No surprise to many. Best of luck the rest of the way, and best of luck whatever happens in the offseason. Take care.
Thanks for having me, guys.
No problem.
David Clarkson. He will go from, fill in this blank, Wish. David Clarkson will go from his cap average of 2.6 to what number come July?
His cap average?
Yeah.
It depends on the suitors. It depends on whether the boys in the blue and white pajamas from your fair city decide to get involved in the bidding. I would go 4.5.
See, I think he's a five. I think he's a $5 million guy going.
You think he's a $5 million player next summer?
Yep, I do.
Wow.
Five.
Is that, again, just because of of the dearth of power forwards available?
It is one of the hardest things to find in the NHL, and when you have one, you try your best not to let it go, and you always overpay. Look, Vancouver is beside themselves right now what they have with Zach Cassian. You know how hard it is to find a power forward? You know, Boston's got a bajillion of them, but they are so hard to, and every team wants one, right? Everybody wants a power forward. And, you know, dude ripped 30 last year, and he's on pace for the same thing this year in a prorated season.
It's not out of the question. I mean, Lucic is a six on a 3-year deal.
Yeah.
So that's not out of the question that Clarkson could be a five. I guess maybe duration has something to do with it, and I guess the amount of suitors has something to do with it, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think your point's a good one. If Big Blue gets involved, then he's a $5 million hockey player going away. Easy. Easy. Someone's at your door, Wish.
It's true. There is. Hang on one second, okay?
Are you getting room service? Greg Wyshynski, by the way, is somewhere in New York City at a hotel room doing this podcast via Skype. I wonder if he just ordered room service. What's that?
I think he's at his friend's house.
Oh, I thought he was at a hotel. Oh, is it his buddy's place? Oh, okay.
Well, he's at his buddy's place.
Yeah. Answering the door right now, which makes for, you know, great cannon fodder here on a podcast.
See, this is the kind of shit that I have to deal with when I'm outside the home studio. People coming to the door and ringing the doorbell. By the way, that was my marijuana shipment. I know the NHL doesn't test for it. So
here's a question for you. If they drug tested the media, who's going to pass and who's going to fail?
Wouldn't that be
an interesting little Dixie Cup experiment?
Well, and honestly, the rise of the alternative and digital media, I think, portends that maybe those tests have gotten a little bit more difficult over the years to pass than when it was just the newspaper guys. I mean, we all know if they tested for whiskey, the newspaper guys would all fail. Now that the hippies and the hipsters have gotten involved, Merrick, it's just gotten out of hand.
I know.
All right. So today, as you know, is Bill Merrick versus Wyshynski going postal. We return to the mailbag because we have a ton of questions to get to.
Quickly, too, because we got a couple of tweets about this. The reason we're not doing a QOD is because today we do the mailbag segment, the Jeff and Greg Go Postal. That's so we're all on the same page there. So.
Correctamundo.
Thanks, man.
This one, folks. Oh, you want to do what? Josh, you want to do the spiffy intro for going postal? I'm sorry, I nearly stepped on it. Let's go to the spiffy intro for our segment.
Do you want to do a mailbag segment every week?
It's time to look deep into the souls of Jeff Merrick and Greg Wyshynski. Whoa, not that deep.
We are nutting up for each other here.
Now's your chance to ask Merrick and Wyshynski anything, and we mean anything.
You got your thinking, Took?
Vegan cooking tips. Favorite Doctor Who characters. What's the best bar in Stouffville? Is there a bar in Stouffville? The meaning of life. Wait, let's not get carried away with that.
We answer your mail.
PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com. On Twitter at Jeff Merrick and at Wyshynski. We're going postal on Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Hey, I want to just give a shout out to the New Jersey Devils Twitter feed who has been tweeting quotes from our David Clarkson interview.
Are you serious? I better go check that out. Well, thank you, New Jersey Devils Twitter feed.
I know, very interesting. And also, Brad B. wants to know if you'd pay Clarkson more than Molson, or do the Islanders have a good deal at $3 million for Molson?
They got a great deal.
I thought the Molson contract was great, personally.
Well, not so great for Matt Molson, but outstanding for the Islanders. Guy rips 30 goals a year, three seasons in a row. And he only gets $3 million. You know the thing that freaks me out about Matt Molson? I don't know if I mentioned this on the podcast before. The guy fills the net every year, scores 30 goals a year, but does Hockey Canada ever give him a sniff for the World Championships?
No.
Never. I could never figure that out.
Two things before I get into the segment. First of all, we need to talk about the Capitals real quick. I don't want to dwell on the Caps. They're a depressing story. It's a season that's starting to slip away a little bit. But somebody brought up the idea the other day that maybe it's just that Adam Oates is an amazing assistant coach or associate coach, but not so much a great head coach. And the example that was given was John McClain. You know, John McClain's a good coach. John McClain found work pretty quickly down in Carolina. He's not a bad coach, but he wasn't a very good head coach for what was a veteran Devils team. Adam Oates, his creds as an assistant coach can't be questioned. I mean, he's great for special teams. He was perfect on that Devils team along with Larry Robinson that went to the Cup final last year. But as a head coach, maybe he's better as an assistant, especially when it comes to taking over a team of veteran players like the Capitals that are now in their third different system in the span of a year.
You want to hear another theory? I spoke to a former coach yesterday while I was at work who feels this way about the Washington Capitals and Adam Oates. He said to me, I think what Adam Oates is doing is too sophisticated and confusing for this team. It makes sense to Adam Oates because he could play that way. He could do all those things. He could think the game that way. But I don't think that type of sophistication is right for this team. Maybe what Adam Oates has is a system that's too complicated for the Washington Capitals to grasp. That was this guy's theory on what's happening with Oates and the Capitals.
Now,
because I'm with you.
When you say too complicated, do you mean too complicated to learn in such a short period of time? Or complicated for a group of
dummies? In general. It makes a lot of sense to a really thoughtful hockey player. And Adam Oates is one of the most creatively gifted hockey players, you know, of the past generation. Not exactly a, you know, surprise that he goes into the Hockey Hall of Fame. But we've seen it before with heady hockey players and great hockey players. Wayne Gretzky being the obvious one behind the bench, in Phoenix. Maurice Richard lasted one game coaching the Quebec Nordiques. We've seen great players, Danny Savard is another one, flop as head coaches because the way they think and the way regular players think are not in concert with one another. It's completely disjointed. I'm just saying, I'm not saying that I agree with it. All I'm saying is this was this guy's theory that Adam Oates is coaching too smart for the Washington Capitals. Let's put it out there.
Theory. It's a very, very interesting theory. Going postal, sir, we have many questions to get to.
Okay.
John Parker wants to know what our favorite pro wrestling finisher is. I'll give you three. Old school overall and attitude era. Okay. Old school, the Macho Man Randy Savage elbow off the top rope is by far the greatest finishing move of that era. It was beautiful. It was artistry. It was a brutal version of the Superfly Snuka, Superfly off the top rope, and it was a beautiful thing to watch. Overall, figure four leg lock. Love it. Love the Ric Flair version, love the Greg Valentine version. Also love the idea that simply by rolling on your belly, you break the hold. And the struggle to get to the ropes to break the hold was also a wonderful thing to watch. And then the Attitude Era, I'm sorry, but the kick boom stunner of Stone Cold Steve Austin was the greatest thing ever because it would come out of nowhere. And also in those interview segments when Austin would be talking with Mr. McMahon and then all of a sudden out of nowhere he'd give him the stunner and then pour beer on his head was really the stuff of legends, sir.
From the Attitude Era, you're wrong. It was the Worm by Scotty Too Hotty. That was the greatest finisher of that era, and you know it, Greg Wyshynski. Old school for me, I loved, and many people have done it, Blackjack Mulligan, Fritz Von Erich, but to me, when Baron Von Raschke in the AWA did the claw, when he would start goose-stepping and hold his right hand and goose-step around the ring before putting the claw on someone's forehead and squeeze the life out of them, that to me was a pretty cool finisher. The Ox Baker heart punch to me was a great one. You pull the hand back behind the head and you punch the guy in the heart. Oh my God, he's giving him a heart attack. That was always a good one for me. And as far as new school ones go, I love this goes to Japanese wrestling. I love the Dragon Suplex. The Dragon Suplex to me was a great finisher.
Can you describe the Dragon Suplex?
It's when you're cupping the arm around the neck. The guy's in front of you, cupping around the neck, and you grab the tights and you and you it's not like your traditional suplex, and you're up and you're almost coming straight. I mean, Tatsuhiro Takaiwa did a really nice sort of variation on it. It's a variation on the suplex that puts all the pressure on the back of the neck when it happens. You're grabbing him and you're throwing him back, and it looks like certain death. Like, oh man, you're snapping a neck here. That to me was my favorite finisher of this modern era.
This is from Trevor in Washington, D.C. When do we start seeing people like Damian Bruner, Rob Shrimp, Linus Omar, and others getting the call up just to do shootouts? I'm with Wish on the shootout, but shootout points helped the New Jersey Devils a lot last year, and lack of them kept Calgary out of the playoffs. I feel like we've been saying that these guys are going to replace the five-minute time on ice, five-penalty minute per night guys at some point, but it still hasn't happened. With so few games this year and each point being so important, is this the year that GMs start gaming for the shootout?
Not there yet, but if the NHL went forward with my idea, which is do shootouts before the game begins, then I think you'll start to see those specialists. And hear me out on this one, Wish. You do a shootout to start every game, and sometimes it'll matter, and sometimes it won't. But if you really love five-on-five play, like if you love, if you put it this way, if you don't like the shootout, you will love my idea of doing a shootout before every single game. Because what happens is you do the shootout to determine the tiebreaker. So the tiebreaker is already set. So if you're tied going into like the last minute of overtime, you are going to see a team throw everything out there and go full on to win that game because a tiebreaker has already been won. So it kind of flies in the face of logic. But if you hate shootouts deciding games, then the best way to do it is do a shootout before every single game. Sometimes it won't matter, but sometimes it really will. And that last minute of the overtime 4-on-4 is going to be special. When a team knows that if it gets down to and the game's over, they've lost, even the score looks at, as you look at the score and it says that it's tied. I think at
I like your idea, but I'd much prefer that to see them spin a giant Price is Right wheel before the game to determine what the tiebreaker would be. The shootout, some wrestling, feats of strength, some kind of a quiz game between the two teams, like a family feud between the two teams. Like, I'd like to know exactly what tie-breaking game we play after regulation rather than just determine the shootout before the game.
Nah, I just like doing shootout before the game, bro. And you got fresh ice. Although, you know the problem with it is, man, you have a lot of goalie injuries. Start the game with shootouts, going east-west, getting twisted up, that might be a little bit of a...
Yeah, but the solution is that they could just skate out and spear a guy with no really repercussions, as we found out the other day.
We've gone over that. Oh, you know what? You know what the other solution to all of this is?
What?
Can we have ties again, please?
Oh, there it is.
I didn't mind a tie. Give me a tie, not just for wearing around your neck.
In my day, we could play, we could kiss our sisters and go home happy. This is from John Buchanan. Greg, what Canadian city would you love to experience a Stanley Cup final in? Same question for Jeff, but an American city. Greg, you can't choose Vancouver, Calgary, or Edmonton because they're in the West. Wait, what kind of question is that? I know what city I'd like to experience the Stanley Cup final in, and I'm sorry about your little canard at the end, John, but it would be Calgary. I was in college, okay, or I'm sorry, I was outside of college. No, it was in college, I think, when the Red Mile stuff was happening, wasn't it? Or was that when they made the cup run in 2004? In either case.
2004 was Red Mile. 2004 was Red Mile.
There are so many beautiful, pale Canadian bosoms being exposed in Calgary during a Stanley Cup run that there is simply no way I wouldn't want to be there for that. Are you out of your mind? It's a no contest. And listen, Ottawa or Winnipeg, I would gladly come to your city as well for a cup final if I knew there was going to be topless women drinking beer. If you can guarantee that, if there is a runway, if you will, for the Jets, if there is a Senate chamber for the for Ottawa, I don't know what you want to call it, but if you can have topless women there with beer, then I will put your names on the list as well. But for me, the city that I'd most like to experience a Stanley Cup final in is Calgary because of boobs. Merrick?
Do you remember what the chant was in 2004 along the Red Mile?
What was it?
It's one of the greatest of all time. Tops off for Kiprusoff. Tops off for Kiprusoff. That's what got the party started. For me, American City, I think Philadelphia would be pretty special. I think New York would be pretty special, but I think the one for me would be Boston. Boston to me, and I've only been to Boston twice, and both times that I've been there, I absolutely loved it. I don't know that I've, and Wish, of course, you've traveled much more extensively to the United States than I have. Spent a lot of time in Michigan, relatives in Livonia and Detroit, but for me, it would be Boston. If I want to go experience the Stanley Cup final, it's going to be Boston, TD Garden, and then partying outside in the streets. I don't know that I've seen or been to a better U.S. party town than Boston. Wish, you know it a lot better than I do. Can you recommend a better Stanley Cup party town in the U.S. than Boston?
No. Well, and being in Boston for that cup final against Vancouver was a real treat because, like, Boston is one of the greatest sports towns in America. And it's not always hockey-centric. The Red Sox, the Patriots, so it's not always about hockey. But during that series, especially after the Horton hit and the whole thing going off the rails for Vancouver, it became all about hockey. It was a beautiful thing to watch. And you're right. I mean, it was a fantastic place to party and a fantastic experience to watch the Cup Final. You're bang on about Boston. It was a hell of a place to go. But, you know, for me, like, this is going to sound crazy because they're so far away from this. But wouldn't you love to see a city that's never experienced it and how they experienced it, like Columbus? Like, can you imagine how insane that town would be, being that it's a college town for a Cup Final?
I got the city. And maybe it's just selfishly because I've always wanted to go there and I never have. And Pete Weber keeps inviting me and I always find a way not to go. Dude, I would love to experience it in Nashville. Wouldn't you love to go to like Stanley Cup Final Game 7, the Nashville Predators win the Stanley Cup, and then you spill out onto the street?
Yeah.
My
lady and I were going to try to go to see Solani in Nashville a week from Saturday, but at the end of our little vacation, but it couldn't happen. The money, it was too much money to fly in, but there is a contingent of people, Ryan Lambert, Jesse Spector, two of them, that are making a pilgrimage to Nashville to catch Solani next Saturday. So that's going to be a good time, I think,
cool.
in Nashville. This is from Andrew. Interesting question. If a guy doesn't get 30 goals this year, like Martin Saint-Louis, does his streak of, like, say, five straight seasons scoring 30 goals end? Do we allow that, you know, like this guy scored 20 goals in 50 consecutive seasons? If he doesn't do it in a shortened season, do we just asterisk it away, or is the streak broken?
No, I think you asterisk it away. Because what's the new 30 now in the NHL? 15? 14?
Yeah.
Is that the new 30?
Yeah.
Peter Bondra I guess they didn't have the Richard Trophy then, but 1994-95, Bondra won the scoring title for goals with 34. Lindros and Jágr tied points, 70. 34 goals now would be about 60, if you prorate?
I guess, yeah.
Stamkos territory. Yeah, I just put the asterisk beside that one. I don't say that a streak. I wouldn't consider it to be a streak was broken.
Tom Ertz Jr., who is Tom Ertz NYR on Twitter, and no doubt is licking his wounds after the Devils game last night. Do you think the National Hockey League would have been better off with a salary cap, with a luxury tax that would allow teams to spend over the limit, but teams did not have to spend to the salary cap floor? So in other words, a cap overage in which you hit teams with a luxury tax, and I'm guessing that money would then be distributed to teams that are hurting financially. I'm actually a fan of that. I'm a big fan of being able to go over the cap, but for specific reasons. You know, maybe you allow an overage late in the season around the trade deadline to allow teams a bit more room to bring in salary. Maybe it's like the contractual thing where you allow teams to go over the cap to sign their own players. But yeah, the bottom line is that you hit them with a massive luxury tax, and then give that money down to the lesser lights in the league. I'm a big fan of allowing that to happen.
I like it. I don't like the idea of getting rid of the salary cap floor, though, because if you're going to have a luxury tax, don't you want that money to go back into the system so teams can remain competitive reasonably?
Yes.
or do you want that money just going into an owner's pocket? Thank you very much. Thanks. We'll take the luxury. We'll take that luxury tax money, New York Rangers, Toronto Maple Leafs, Philadelphia Flyers, and we'll put it in our hip pocket. I'd rather see that money go back.
I'm with you. Like, I'm a fan of the salary cap floor, but I'm not a fan of it being as high as it's been. Because then you get stupid contracts, and then you get cap chicanery in order to try to hit that number. But I like the idea of demanding that teams spend a certain amount of money, because what's the point if you're not? You know, it's a protection to the fans that teams are going to try to be competitive and not just simply, you know, lay down for 3 years to get a bunch of number one picks.
Here's the problem, too. If you're not going to have a salary cap floor, I don't know that you could have free agency set at 7 years or 27 in the NHL.
Yeah.
That to me just seems inherently unfair, that just because you're in the draft position that you are, a team has you locked up for 7 years and they're not paying any money to any players. If you're going to do it that way, then you know what? Coming out of your ELC, you're not a restricted free agent. You're an unrestricted free agent.
Indeed. Good call. Wow, so many people chiming in. This going postal thing was the greatest idea we ever came up with, by the way, outside of all the other great ideas that we've had.
Well, yeah, the idea of answering email is a great idea. Wow, we're geniuses. We're brilliant. We're going to get corner offices out of this one for sure, Greg.
I'm such a dick. this is from Vellucci. Bobby Dallas, by the way, Random Penguin. Having listened to almost every podcast, I know that Merrick has his favorite players like David Clarkson, Ryan O'Reilly, Ryan Strome, Barrett Jackman, etc., and that Wish loves Scott Stevens and some other Devil's Grace. I was wondering, which players do you guys despise or dislike, either active players or anyone who has played? It's a great question. Players that I despise. Here's the thing, like, and I hate to say this because I know he's a very likable guy and everybody does sort of like him, but I never liked Mike Gartner. I never liked him for that thing.
Really?
Goals, and it never meant anything. He never won anything in his career. It was a lot of goals. Maybe I didn't like him because he was a Ranger during a very formative time for me as a young lad, but I never liked Mike Gartner. Never. And it's not like intense dislike, I'm sure, like, Montreal fans feel towards Brad Marchand or Boston fans feel towards Alex Burrows. I never liked Mike Gartner.
I think mine, and now I can't think of really anyone that I don't like, because I don't get that, you know, emotionally, you know, wound up. I don't like hate Rafi Torres. I don't hate Alex Burrows or, you know, Max Lapierre. I just don't have that in me. But I remember as a kid, I couldn't stand Ken Dryden. Well, don't forget, like, I'm 8 years old, I'm a Maple Leafs fan, and who's crushing the Maple Leafs? Like, who's destroying the Maple Leafs game in and game out? And I was a big Mike Palmateer guy, and Dryden was always better. Now, Bernie Parent was the best goaltender in the entire NHL through that era, but Ken Dryden was always the guy in that classic rivalry, Toronto and Montreal. He was the one that the Maple Leafs, whether it was Lanny, whether it was Daryl, whether it was Errol, whether it was Boria, whether it was Ian, nobody could score on. Ken Dryden was the bane of my existence when I was a young kid, for sure. That would be my guy.
I'll give you another guy, too, that I just thought of on more of the I despise every fiber of his being guy, which was Ty Domi. I hated Domi because I thought he was a clown with the Rangers. And then taking out Niedermeyer behind the play the way he did, I thought that was just terrible. I mean, just criminal. Domi was a guy that I hated, I can say, as a fan, without question. I don't think I'm alone in that. I'm sure Domi probably had a number of guys that weren't exactly fans of what he did. Right, you figure?
Yeah, you know what? Ty Domi was, and I've had an interesting past with Ty. He introduced me to one of the coolest guys in the world, and I'm blanking on his name there. Chris Falcone. Remember the guy that fell into the penalty box with Ty Domi? Okay, so the guy's name is Chris Falcone. Owns a construction company in Philadelphia. Dude, not only did I meet that guy, I partied with that guy. Did I not tell you this story?
I don't think you did. This is a story that I'm surprised in the 2 years we've done the show has not come up. You partied with the guy who fell into the penalty box with Ty Domi.
Chris Falcone. Chris Falcone is the most awesome guy in the world. This would have been, 03, maybe 04? I was working at AM640 doing the Leafs Lunch program, and we ran a promotion with another sports company that sent people to, you know, various sporting events, and we ran a trip from Toronto to Philadelphia. And I had talked to Chris Falcone, we had booked him on Leafs Lunch, just to talk about what happened being in the penalty box with Ty Domi and all that. And so I was talking to Chris after, I'm like, hey, man, I'm coming to Philadelphia. Let's get together and get a beer. No. We got the tour of Philadelphia. We got the Hoagie tour. We got the, you know, all the famous monuments tour, the Liberty Bell tour, and the Gentleman's Parlor tour as well from Philly, Chris Falcone. It was 2 days and one hockey game. Flyers won 5-1. It's a playoff game. Aki Berg swirled the lone goal for the Maple Leafs in that one. But honestly, he is one of the coolest, most generous, like thoughtful, nice guys you will ever meet. Dude knows how to party. There was one gentleman's club that he took me and my former producer Punch to. Oh God, what was it? I mean, we ended up all getting massages because he knew. It was so bizarre in the middle of the strip club, all getting massages right by the runway. Chris Falcone, dude, I don't know if you listen to this podcast, but I got to get back in touch with you because you are awesome. That guy was so much fun to party with. It was 2 days of just mayhem with Chris Falcone. That was great.
This is from Casey Ippolito. Wish you have a particular way of saying Stanley Cup that drives me nuts. Your emphasis is all wrong. You say Stanley Cup in this odd way. I'm sure Merrick and your listeners know what I'm talking about. I know this is more of a rant than a question, so I guess my question is, how do you live with yourself? Thanks for the hours of great entertainment, good sir. I don't think I say it that wrong. I mean, it's Stanley Cup, right? The Stanley Cup playoff.
It's
the Stanley Cup final.
No, it's not.
What's wrong with
Stanley
that?
Cup. It's Stanley Cup. It's the Stanley Cup, not Stanley Cup. You're putting the accent on the wrong syllable.
It's the Stanley Cup final.
It's the Stanley Cup final.
Stanley Cup final.
You go Stanley, like you're coming up on it.
Right.
Stanley Cup final.
Stanley Cup final?
It's not Stanley Cup. It's not Stanley Valley Girl. No, it's not. I know everything has to round out at the end of your sentence. That's what we
talk about. WANBC. WANBC.
Stanley Cup.
It's preposterous.
What?
Stanley I say it Cup? The right way. Everybody else is wrong. That's how I feel about
you. You are putting the accent on the wrong syllable, my friend.
Slabble.
The accent.
This
on
is
the
from
wrong
Ryan
syllable.
C. Hey fellas, I want to get your take on the Ronaldo and Crombean fight last night. I'm in the same boat as Harrison Mooney. When Crombean went down, Ronaldo should have stopped punching him. I've been in enough fights being a bouncer that when a guy goes down, you stop no matter how much you hate them. Wow, bouncer, right? What do you think about that? You know, there were two incidents in that game, the Ronaldo-Crombean fight, where it looked like Ronaldo gave Crombean a late punch, and then the Talbot-Lecavalier fight, in which Vinny definitely gave Talbot a late punch, or three.
Yes, he did. I don't like it, but I'm not going to come down hard on Zach Ronaldo. After all, it's a fight. It's an emotional moment. The adrenaline is flowing. Let's not forget, too, it's a home rank fight for Ronaldo. So you're pumped, and I can understand getting one or two in while the player's on his way down, I guess. I don't like it. Like, I like the way Aaron Asham fights. When a guy's down, that's it. He does a thing where he puts his hands up and, okay, this thing's over. I'm done. That I like, but I can understand how a player, you know, would get caught up in the moment and hit a guy when he's on his way down. So I'm not really ready to condemn Zach Ronaldo as much as maybe Harrison Mooney is. Having said that, you know, when that fight happened yesterday, we were watching it at Sportsnet, so we went back and watched a bunch of old Zach Ronaldo fights, not just in the NHL, like even like not that long ago where he did the exact same thing to Matt Hendricks when Hendricks was down, fired off another one at him. But you go back to his OHL career when he played with the Barry Colts, man, it didn't matter if the guy was standing or the guy was down. Zach Ronaldo was punching the dude. And that's cool. If you want to do that, if you want to be that guy, I get it. It's a fight, but someone is going to get him and hurt him if that's the reputation he's going to get. Because
the Vinny thing for me is tough because I don't think anyone, maybe he wasn't available after the game or whatever, but I want to know if that's a reaction to the Ronaldo thing. Like, it's not, but Talbot's not a dirty player by any stretch. And I mean, he pounded Talbot while Talbot was flat on his stomach. And I got to imagine that's got to be some reaction to something.
If you don't think
to get into his brain and find out if it in fact was sort of retribution for what happened with Ronaldo and Crombean or not, but that was Listen, for all the Flyers fans that are like, where is all the criticism of Le Cavalier? That's breaking the code. He did something terrible last night, and he shouldn't have done it.
Although, I mean, that has to be payback. Because don't you think that on the bench and in the room, the guys were talking about the late punch by Zach Rinaldo? Of course
not. I hope so.
And that was, in a lot of ways, you could say that was a captain's moment. That was something that a captain of a hockey team does. All right, yep. You do this to us, we're going to do this right back to you.
Yep.
Finney had Talbot in a vulnerable spot, and he fired a couple more at him.
Well, it was like old times, huh? Gimla scores a goal, the Cavalier gets into a fight. It's been 2004 final. By the way, Brandon Dubinsky, $10,000 fine from the NHL. So no suspension because there shouldn't have been, and we get to see the NHL now flexing its increased fine muscles after the $2,500 cap was gone by the wayside in the last CBA.
I still don't like the $10,000, but I'm just glad it wasn't a suspension. Because you're just trying to
finish. Yeah, I think a suspension would have been egregious. You want to fine a guy and just do one of these, hey, everybody remember, you need to keep your head screwed on straight as far as hits along the end boards. That's fine. But the suspension would have been too much. Finally, on this edition of Going Postal, the last edition of Going Postal until February 20th, because I am off next week and there'll be no fresh potties next week. We're taking a potty break, as we put it yesterday.
That's nice.
Brian LeChance writes in, Wish, what will be your beer of choice while on vacation? Random Penguin and Whaler, Paul Coffee. Brian, the place that I'm going is lovely. It's an island in the Caribbean. And I'm not sure what kind of beer they have there. When I was in Belize, they had this amazing beer called Belican. And one of the true joys in life is going someplace tropical and finding out what they drink. Now, this place might be a rum place. I know in my travels in the Caribbean, I've imbibed many Tortuga rums, for example, and they've been all delicious. Or it might be a beer place, or it might not. I don't know. But I know this, and this is a golden rule for yours truly, and I'm sure many of the non-teetotalers in our audience would agree, drink locally. Wherever you go,
drink locally. That's the key,
man. Don't go someplace and buy yourself a six-pack of Coors Light the minute you get there. Drink locally. Oh. It's part of understanding the culture of where you are. I know where I'm going. Me and the lady will be on the beach sucking down local suds, drinking local rum, and doing what we can. And you know what? If it sucks, well, then we'll go out and get something good. But for the most part, drink locally is the mantra. And also eat locally, too. Don't be like my parents that go on vacation and go eat at Applebee's because they know what the menu looks like, okay? Go to the sketchiest place you can find, sit down, and say, give me the best thing in the house. The essence of traveling is getting out of your comfort zone. And, yeah, that burrito you eat at the place that has a wood shack, a wood roof, and the doors falling off the front, it might make you sick. You might be sick for days, but you know what? Mm-hmm. It'll still taste better in that moment than something from Applebee's does.
Because, damn it, I'm somewhere else eating this. It's always better. The wine is a little nicer. The beer is a little colder. The food's a little more delicious because I'm somewhere else. I couldn't agree with you more. I always do the same thing. Wherever I go, always do it local, specifically with the beer. I'm curious to see what your beer finds are going to be. Because I know you're going to go down there and you're going to sample all the different suds.
Yeah, I'll come back with a full report. And by the way, the offer still stands. Anybody listening to the show who wants to guess where I'm going, I will confirm or deny. But I'm not going to tell you straight away. But that's it, folks. That's it for a week. We're going to do some best of stuff next week for the folks who are on iTunes and want to get freshies and stuff, and we'll definitely do that. But that's all until I get back. Next fresh show for me, Merrick, is February 18th.
I'm back with you, bud. I'm back right, with you. So, hey,
a well-deserved break for myself and my radio buddy, because after all, Merrick, we worked through the lockdown.
Oh, I know. 3 days a week. It was agony. You know what? whenever I start complaining about my job, I think of like a single mother who holds down two jobs in order to feed her family and keep her family afloat. And I think to myself, wow, I'm like complaining because I have to stay at Sportsnet until 1:30 in the morning tonight. Yeah. And I get to talk about hockey. Oh, I got to put on a suit and put on makeup and get my hair did. Yeah. I don't really work. And yes, we did work through the lockout, but you know what, though? I kind of dug it.
We're taking a little break. We're resting up, recharging the batteries. When we come back, we promise that the plans for some events for the listeners will come into more focus. And thanks for supporting the show. And again, you know, we hate leaving you for a week or whatever, but, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder, as they say, Jeff Merritt.
Oh, they'll be loving us then by the time we come back. Can I ask you a question? Quickly,
yeah.
a couple of rapid fires here. Is Jonas Enroth done? Is he done? Can I give you a quick little stat here? I mean, yesterday, geez, I mean, that was Ottawa got out to the early lead, you know, lit up Jonas Enroth and then just sort of held on. In the first 22 games of Jonas Enroth's career, you know what his record was? 16-4-2. You know what his record is in the last 17 games of his career? 1-12-4.
Wow.
Is he done?
He might be. He might be. And maybe like that's, remember, there was an entire thing about trying to put the reins on him and trade Ryan Miller, right? Where did that talk go?
Oh, yeah. Remember, yeah, because Miller was going to Anaheim. And, hey, they have Jonas Enroth. Everything will be fine.
Yep.
Yeah.
Where'd that go?
Yeah. Not so much. You wonder if he's the new Patrick Laleem. In Buffalo. Mika Kiprusoff, the lower body injury. Danny Taylor signed a 1-year two-way contract, $525 over $80. Wish, true or false, the Calgary Flames go as Mika Kiprusoff does?
I would say true.
And anything else I wanted to get to? Ryan Nugent-Hopkins doesn't play tonight. So calling all centers, they are down Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, Sean Hurkoff, and Eric Bélanger against Dallas this evening.
I will ask you a question, sir.
So,
with their victory, do we start fitting the Chicago Blackhawks for their crown as the kings of the Western Conference?
I don't want to Barry Horowitz it here, but in our Sportsnet preview show, I believe it was a young vegan Jeff Merrick who said the Chicago Blackhawks will be coming out of the Western Conference and face the New York Rangers in the Stanley Cup Final. I may be only half right.
Hey, listen, there's one more going close that we have to get to. Andrew Tomlinson just reminded me of this on Twitter, and it was a question that we both liked in the pre-show, but then forgot to actually get to in the real show. If either of us could get any hockey moment tattooed on us, what would it be?
Oh, that one. That's a great
tattoo. Here's my tattoo I'd get because I don't have any tattoos. I'm not like, you know, the jigsaw man that I do the show with over here, you know, tatted up like crazy.
Yeah,
But I've often thought about getting tattoos in the backs of my legs. Like, I think that's a cool place to do a tat. So I would do two goalies. I would do on the right leg the classic Ken Dryden pose from the cover of The Game because it's like my favorite hockey book. And then on the other leg, I do Jim Craig celebrating the Miracle on Ice would be the two tattoos I'd get.
You know what would drive Sabres fans nutty? Because he did it with a pumpkin. If Brett Hall got that goal, the 99 goal tattooed on him somewhere and then tweeted that out.
Hey, ladies, that might be that greatest Brett Hall tattoo might be something to consider, by the way. Just saying.
I don't know what I would hockey tattoo. Man, that's a tough one. If it's gonna be, if it's gonna be a player, it'd probably be Bobby Orr. If it's gonna be an event, I still think it's the greatest hockey photograph ever taken—the Barilko goal from 51, the Natsurovsky shot. That might be it. That's a pretty involved piece, and my entire back is already covered, and that'd be the best canvas for it. Yeah. So I'd look for something.
Or I would get the Dano Chara on my penis, but only the waist up, obviously, because if you're going to make it to scale.
Wow, you would get Greg Wyshynski.
I'm sorry, that's so terrible. I meant to say Nathan Gerby.
You would get Greg Wyshynski. You would get a W on each of your butt cheeks, so when you bent over, it said "Wow."
Jeff Merrick.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Have a good time down south, Wish.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I'm glad we were able to leave you with that image. thanks, everybody. And we will talk to you soon, man. We'll talk to you next Monday the 18th, folks, is when we come back into your lives. Thanks for supporting the show, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye.